I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of La Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started La Bernardin in 1986 with her brother Gilbert after operating the restaurant with the same name in Paris. When Gilbert died from a heart attack in 1994, Eric Repair took over as the restaurant's co-owner and chef. Maggie and Eric are co-authors of La Bernardin Cookbook. La Bernardin has been awarded 3 Michelin stars and has held 4 stars from the New York Times since it opened. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are your earliest memories of eating fish?
Oh, from the very beginning, I didn't like meat. So that was easy. When I was very young, 3-4 years old, I was eating in the dining room in our little hotel restaurant in Brittany with my brother, and we were eating fish.
So you lived in Brittany, and your parents operated a small hotel restaurant. How involved were you in the restaurant? What roles did you have?
We were involved very, very early, like peeling potatoes. We were stuffing clams. We were 7 or 8 years old. I was in the dining room with my mother, and my brother was in the kitchen with my father. And then my father had this idea, as he had 2 grown-up kids, to open a disco.
Tell me about the disco. This is now in the 1960s?
Yes, and it was one of the first disco in Brittany, so we were very successful, but we didn't know how to make money. And then later on, my brother was in his early 20s, he was working as in a disco in Paris. And then he really learned how to make money.
What kind of music played in the disco at the time?
The music of the Rolling Stone.
And your grandfather was a fisherman. Do you recall going out with him to catch fish?
Not me. I didn't like too much going on the boat, but my brother really liked doing that. And he preferred to go on the boat with my grandfather than to go to school, to tell you the truth. He was very young when he started to go on the boat with him. And one day there was a tempest that raised very quickly, and they had to tie him up with ropes to prevent him to be thrown away off the boat.
Did you both know from the early days that you wanted to go into business together and open a restaurant together? How did that happen?
Not at all. I wanted to be a stewardess, and my brother wanted to work on boats, but the kind of big boats where they go far away.
Cargo?
Yes, cargo.
Ah. Why did you want to be a stewardess?
Because I wanted to get out of Brittany and travel. That was it. I knew early in my life that I would not stay in Brittany. It was too remote, and I knew that there was a life somewhere else.
Eventually, you and your brother moved to Paris.
Yes.
But before opening the restaurant, you dabbled in different areas
yes.
for a few years. What are
exactly.
some of the things that you did?
I modeled for a couple of years. Then I was a receptionist in an hotel. Then I was hostess in a restaurant. And every year we would come back to Brittany to help our parents.
How did you both then make the decision to open the restaurant?
Because there was nothing else that we knew. We didn't know that it was going to be so difficult, because the small training that we had in that small hotel restaurant was not enough to make a success in Paris. So we opened that restaurant in Paris in 72 with the help of everyone, friends, family, loan at the bank. It was a disaster. We didn't know how to run the restaurant to make money. We were having fun being outside every night after when the restaurant was closed. And several times we thought that we would we had to file for bankruptcy.
Your restaurant was almost taken away at one point.
That's right.
What is the story behind that?
One day I went for whatever reason to the market with my brother. And we came back with the small car full of fish, and we saw a notice on the window, for sale. This is our restaurant, this is us. It said, so I called the number and a man came. He said, all right, young lady, I'm going to help you. Can we sit somewhere? I said, yes, please come to my apartment. It's above the restaurant. He said, I'm going to help you. We can just take a lean on your furniture. What do you have? Here, I have one table, which is my desk, and two chairs. And I have my bedroom. I have my bed, and that's it. He said, that's the only thing I cannot take. So it's to show you how difficult it has been.
But despite this difficulty initially, you were actually opening a restaurant at an auspicious moment. Your brother, who was a chef with no formal training, benefited from a new experimentation going on in the French culinary community at the time. What impact do you think that had on your brother's cooking?
It was the beginning of the nouvelle cuisine. He tried to have some imagination. All the chefs were trying new way to get out of that heavy French cooking. So it was, in a way, the right time. He became friendly with all the chefs of his generation, went to have dinner with them, started to travel with them. They were always invited everywhere in France, whether it's to taste the truffles that were coming out or to taste wine. That's when everything started to come in his mind, I suppose.
And the first restaurant was called Le Bernardin.
It was called Le Bernardin, yes.
What does that mean?
It is a song that our father was singing to us called Les Moines de Saint Bernardin. Those monks were well known for the good life. They liked to eat and to drink. And that first location was on the left bank, not far from the restaurant that we were going to open. So we named the restaurant after those monks.
So you're talking about monks in a monastery? There's a monastery,
yes,
close to you? And monks obviously are known for their asceticism.
Yes, not those one.
I see. And so your father would sing this song to,
yes,
you growing up?
Yes. It's a well-known song.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started Le Bernardin in 1986 with her brother, Gilbert. You operated the Paris restaurant from 1972 to 1987 in two locations.
Yes.
And the impetus for your closing the restaurant in Paris was that you opened up a New York restaurant.
Exactly.
In 1986.
Yes.
Why did you decide to move to New York?
It's very difficult to say because I didn't know New York. It's out of the blue. I was pushed by I don't know what or who, but it was very strong. And I started in the 1980 already to think about New York. I came once with my brother and we stayed 2 weeks, and my brother said, there is nothing here, there is no good vegetable, there is no herb, there is nothing, there is, we cannot open a restaurant. And I told him, you are a coward. But he said, no way, we are not ready, and this town is not ready. We cannot do it. So a few years later, I told him, I don't want to stay here all my life. You will be 50 years old with a big belly behind your stove, and I will be with white hair at the entrance. I told him, I don't want a family. I'm not interested. I just want to run another business.
So you're eager to open a restaurant in New York. Your brother, not so much. What next? You tried a few times to start a restaurant, but investors repeatedly fell through.
It took me several times. One time I thought that I had everything. I had 10 different investment partner friends. And at the last minute, there was always one who would say no. And one year, I came back and I had almost a nervous breakdown because a deal didn't go through.
And then finally, a partnership randomly came together with essentially a stranger in New York City.
You met Mr. Holloway, who was the head of Equitable.
Yes, he was the chairman of Equitable.
And Equitable is the real estate company that owns the building that you've been in.
Yes.
How did you meet him?
We met him through a friend of mine whose brother was a very good friend of Ben Holloway. And he knew that he was finishing that huge building on the west side, which was not at that time a very well-known location.
155 West 51st Street.
So we went to his house. We opened a bottle of Dom Pérignon. We shook hands, said, that's it, we have a deal. Do you have an architect? Yes, we do. Tell your architect to get in touch with the architect of the building tomorrow. Do you have a lawyer? Yes, we do. Tell your lawyer to get in touch with the lawyer of the building and let's work on him. I said, but we don't have a deal. He said, we'll work on that. So they started to build the restaurant. We signed the deal 6 months later. He had so much trust and confidence with us that he knew that we were going to do it.
What was the restaurant landscape at the time in that neighborhood in Midtown?
It was not a good neighborhood. At night, we had some of our employees who were mugged. Nobody thought that it could be a right location. And we thought that it was going to be a right location because we were next to Rockefeller Center and next to Broadway.
But it was kind of accidental that you launched in this neighborhood.
Yes, that's right, because we had a very good deal.
How did you get financing from the beginning? Even you had Equitable as your landlord.
Yes.
But did they provide the capital to get the restaurant off the ground?
It was a turnkey operation.
A turnkey operation?
Yes, meaning that they would do all the work and then buy table, chairs, china, glassware, everything.
Lucky you.
Yes.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. We'll hear more from Maggie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. She partnered with celebrity chef Eric Rappaire after Gilbert died in 1994. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011.
Now, your brother came to New York kicking and screaming because it was your wish. Did you ever think that maybe you and your brother should part ways because you wanted to be in New York and he wanted to be in Paris?
Well, no, we were very, very close and that was enough.
Your brother was protesting that there are no good herbs and no good vegetables. Where did he find, or where did you both find, the produce and the fish for your restaurant in Midtown?
The good thing was that New York is on the water, so Gilbert figured out that some fish were going to come to New York. He just had to find where to find them. He went to the Fulton Fish Market. Was the first restaurateur ever going to the fish market. That was very interesting because he made the fish market discovered by the journalist who came with him, and then the TV went with him to the fish market, and suddenly the fish market has been known, and then the fishmonger was happy to be on TV, so we were treated very well with them.
So your brother brought publicity to Fulton Fish Market.
Yes.
Because journalists and the TV crew would follow your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your brother did not speak English very well.
Gilbert didn't speak English. So his way to connect with them was just pointing out the fish and just pointing out the fish that they wanted to sell, which is no good. He would say, no, no good. And that was it. And after a while, they understood that he really knew how to choose the fish.
So your brother was an expert in fish thanks to his family upbringing.
Yes, thanks to my grandfather, who was the fisherman.
And when you were first launching the restaurant in 1986, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
We could not find waiters. So we took our maitre d' from Paris with us, and the dining room became a school for 1 month. And we had at that time the biggest kitchen in New York. We had the first page of the New York Times with a picture of the kitchen. And we were serving dinner every night in the kitchen to train the waiters. And then we started to train waiters in the dining room, like having just 5 or 6 tables and increasing every day. And we had no publicity, no public relation to help us, just people would see that there was light and that Le Bernardin, they heard that Le Bernardin was opening, and they would knock at the door and say, when are you going to be open? We said, we don't know, when we will be ready. And one night, Gilbert said, okay, we'll be ready soon. Maggie, you get 50 people in the dining room and nothing else for 1 month.
Do you remember what was on the menu the first night when you opened?
We had raw fish on the menu. Nobody in New York had eaten raw fish except in a few sushi places. So I would take the order at the table with the maître d' and convince people to try to take the raw fish. And I would say, please, try it. And if you don't like it, we'll give you something else. There was a lot of tuna in New York. And the tuna, when it's too cooked, it's not good at all. So I said to my brother, listen, why don't we serve it raw? So we had carpaccio of tuna. We had some raw fish marinated that we serve on a green salad. We had sea urchin, which was not very popular. So we had a sea urchin in a butter of sea urchin. We had oyster, of course. We had oyster with truffle, which was very unusual as well. We had fish soup. We had skate.
Squid.
Yes. We had served monkfish, which was not very well known either, that we would serve with leeks.
All that on the first night?
Oh, yes. When we were ready, we were ready. And every week, I would increase a little bit.
Now, your responsibilities were always split between your being in the front of the house and his always being the chef. Did you ever try to cook yourself?
No, I never tried because I never had the opportunity. That was not the tradition in the 50s and 60s to have women in the dining room. It was women in the front and men in the kitchen.
You mentioned that your brother had no traditional training and
That's right.
He was really more of an artist and he used his imagination. How did that help him in the kitchen, do you think, versus having a formal training?
Because our food was different, was very light. There was some broth, then emulsion.
Emulsion.
Yes. Spice with herbs. His menu was simple, but that's what was important because then really people started to appreciate the fish. And the fish was so fresh that it was really good.
You mentioned green salad, that you served fish on top of green salad.
Yes. Oh, that was a big deal.
What was Gilbert's relationship with salad?
Oh, a nightmare. Because we had customer coming and asking for a green salad. And he says, no, we are not serving green salad. I said, why not? Because you are in the restaurant, it's a fish restaurant, and I don't go to the fish market every night to serve a green salad. That was it. We would not serve green salad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and La Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Incidentally, when exactly did you open the restaurant to the public?
The restaurant was ready by November 1985. We knew that it was not the right time to open in the middle of the season, but we opened in January, which had always been successful for us. All the restaurants that we opened in January.
What were some of the mistakes you made in the early days of the restaurant?
I don't think we made mistakes. We were strong enough not to open the restaurant and to accept a lot of customers the first 2 months. So when Gail Green, who was the first person who reviewed the restaurant, came, the restaurant was ready. Her friends was telling her, you must go to the restaurant, it's really good. She said, I promised them not to go before they tell me that they are ready. So finally she came, and Brian Miller came right away.
Brian Miller of the New York Times.
Yes.
Which gave you 4 stars.
4 stars, which was a big deal for him because it was the first, it was at the beginning of him being at the New York Times, and it was the first 4 star that he gave. In his first article that he did, he said, I wish that we can take their passport so that they don't go back to France. And suddenly we were overwhelmed with the phones. We couldn't answer the phones. We had 5 persons on the reservation, and it was not enough. We had to buy a sophisticated answering machine to take over. Nobody could reach us. It was very special. It was special days.
When you got your 4 stars from the New York Times,
yes.
Do you remember that moment when you found out?
Yes, we found out because by coincidence, we had that night friends coming from France, and I said, you arrive right on time. Tonight we are going to see what we are going to get with the New York Times. The manager came at that moment with plenty of New York Times in his hands and threw away the newspaper in the restaurant.
The manager threw the newspaper in the air.
Absolutely. And in the private room, we had a reservation. It was 15 people. And they were all people from the New York Times. They all came down the stairs, and everybody was applauding.
Oh.
And everyone in the restaurant started to understand. So everyone started to applaud, and it was really a wonderful moment. And then we went outside to celebrate. When we came back, we called our father and explained him. And he said, so, you didn't go to the Fulton Fish Market this morning, my son?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Your brother, Gilbert, passed away in 1994 from a heart attack?
From a heart attack, yes.
Was it sudden?
Yes, it was sudden, but not really. A year before, he had a kind of small attack. At night, he woke up and his girlfriend, she rushed him to the hospital. And 3 days later, he asked the maître d' and Eric and the manager to come to the hospital with the mail, and in front of them he took all the tube that he had in his hand. He said, I am fine, and don't say anything to my sister or you will be fired.
So he took out all the tubes, all the needles and tubes from the hospital?
Yes. If I had known, I would have battled and fight with him so that to do the test. He was supposed to do tests that he never did.
So your brother kept his heart attack a secret so you wouldn't worry and force him to undergo a series of tests.
Yes.
Eric Repair, your now chef and co-owner,
yes,
came on board, took over in 1994 when your brother passed away. Eric had been working in the kitchen with Gilbert.
With Gilbert, yes.
What was that relationship like?
Gilbert was very friendly with Jean-Louis Paladin, a very well-known chef who was running a restaurant in the Watergate Hotel in Washington. He's the first French chef who came to United States. And Gilbert asked him if he had someone that he could recommend because he knew that that could not go further than what he has done, that he really need new blood. And Jean-Louis Paladin introduced him to my brother. And Eric, it took like a few months before Eric accepted it. They were meeting every Saturday at breakfast and talked about everything. They became friends before they became the chef of the restaurant.
Now, Eric's style of cooking is very different from your brother's. Gilbert was more ad hoc and there was no formal education, whereas Eric is well-schooled.
Oh, yes. Eric has the best training.
How is that manifested in the menu? How is the menu different as a result of now having Eric on board versus Gilbert?
When Gilbert died, I said to Eric, Eric, we have to stop. Don't do it at all, anything that Gilbert was doing, except the raw fish. We'll keep that, and everything has to be new.
How come?
Because I wanted to really to show that I should no longer think of my brother, and that Eric was a chef, and that he was talented, and that I wanted to show his talent.
I could see it going the other way. I could see some owners saying, I want you to continue in my brother's tradition. So it was probably freeing for Eric to have that
yes.
license from you.
Yes, definitely.
When the reviewers came to review the restaurant under Eric's auspices,
yes.
what were the
It was Ruth Reichel in 1995.
And?
4 stars.
4 stars.
Yes.
New York Times. Are you tearing up because this is emotional for you?
Absolutely. It's 40 years of my life. But I have Eric and I, we are very close. We are like friends. I consider him like more than a business partner. He's my family. He's like my brother in a sense.
And Eric is really the public face of the restaurant to some degree. The star of a TV series called Avec Eric,
yes.
And a judge on Top Chef. How do you feel about his taking on that role with the restaurant, whereas you're more, not behind the scenes, because you're in from the front of the restaurant, but you certainly don't have your own TV series, and you're not the one that has as much fame as he.
It's wonderful. I can go away whenever I want. And nobody is asking for me. Everybody is asking for Eric. It doesn't make a difference if I am there or not, because I have a computer everywhere I go. I do the administration work in the restaurant. So every day I speak with everyone and I look at the numbers and that's fine.
Now, how has your job changed from the inception, from 1986 when you opened to now? What does your job entail?
In 1986, I was in the front. I was at the podium greeting people and then going to one table to the other, seeing if everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And then I would be in the restaurant from 6 o'clock to midnight, saying goodbye to the last customer. Plus the work in the office, it was very long days.
How has your clientele's taste changed from the beginning of the restaurant's opening till now?
They are very sophisticated now, yes. I don't remember, but what I can tell you is in one night we could have 15 tables taking tasting menus with wine pairing. So it means that the clientele is really sophisticated. They know about food.
There are so many restaurateurs expanding and having 2, 3, 5, 10 restaurants, whether they're all in New York or in other states. How come you're sticking with Labenardine only.
This is our choice. We like to be unique. When the customer comes, we want that experience to be very special. We always manage to be in the restaurant, either Eric or me, so that the customer can have that special experience. If they want to meet with us, we are there.
What is your diet like? What did you eat for breakfast this morning?
I eat cornflakes with skim milk, grapefruit that the restaurant prepared for me, and Greek yogurt. And lunch, it's green salad with vegetables and fruits.
How often are you eating in the restaurant?
Every day, lunch and dinner. And dinner, I pick up everything from the menu. I taste everything. And I sit down in the dining room, and I want to be served like a customer. That's where I see the details.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Labenardine. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Nous sommes les moines de Saint-Bernardin. Nous sommes les moines de Saint-Bernardin. Nous nous couchons tard et nous levons matin.
Nous nous couchons tard et nous levons matin.
Pour aller à matine, vider quelques flacons. Voilà ce qui est bon et bon, bon, bon.
Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie.
Pour notre souper de bons petits oiseaux.
Pour notre souper de bons petits oiseaux.
Que l'on nomme Caille, Bécasse ou Perdreau.
Que l'on nomme Caille, Bécasse ou
Et la fine andouillette et la tranche de jambon. Voilà ce qui est bon et bon, bon, bon.
Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie chérie. Ha, ha. Et voilà la vie que tous les moines font. Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie chérie. Ha, ha. Et voilà la vie que tous les moines font.
Dans un lit au drap blanc.
Pour notre coucher dans un lit au drap blanc.
Une belle nonne de 15 à 16 ans.
Une belle nonne de 15 à 16 ans.
Qui a les formes bien grasses et les appâts bien ronds. Voilà ce qui est bon et bon, bon, bon.
Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie chérie.
Ah, ah.
Et voilà la vie que tous les moines font. Et voilà la vie, la vie, la vie, la vie chérie.
Ah, ah.
Et voilà la vie que tous les moines font.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8"?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers, actually, who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, what about me? You know, they manage. They go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun. But, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, oh, we're so glad you're doing this. It's, my husband's just, she's so happy and all that. And she said, there used to be a store in Washington that closed. And I said, oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that? She said, oh, it's called the Short Men Shop. And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this. And they go, oh, really? That sounds interesting. You know, I do okay. And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, hey, you gonna do polo shirts?
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys department.
What is the tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the money, the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway signs are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched in February 2012.
Oh, yeah,
so,
we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that you're, you know, I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. But I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire, you know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band there. He can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's just a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and Turn It Down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible, incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day, going, "Oh yeah, I got the show. It's The Sopranos." I remember vividly thinking to myself, "Wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type." Because I thought it was I had no idea. I mean, so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. Mm. And it kind of, you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And everyone's working for nothing in conditions that are like, you know, almost tawdry. And you sort of do it and get it on and it works. And it just, I knew, and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just, I thought, that's not going to happen again. So, you know what, let me just put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid, was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought there was no way for both of us to have really the careers that you need to have in the theater, because you have to give 110% in theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant. And we had an incredible interview where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, you know, it was work, so nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving. But he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and, you know, so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. You know, we were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer too. So she's got to sort of blaze that trail too and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia.
I did. And
focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who'd been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah. It's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows, and has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in my developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. You know, there's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving in the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell bottoms anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it as vividly as, you know, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell bottoms is my rosebud. You know what I mean? So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, nine years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I have this mustard pair of, like, you know, sort of pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. You know, other five-year-olds are not saying that. And that doesn't mean you're gay, but I mean, it was, so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hid it, and like lots of people did, and came out when I was 21, and everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, you know, from the age of five. How about your parents?
My mother was really, you know, she dressed beautifully. You know, she knew that girl. You know, she taught at a girls' school, and she knew girls were watching. So she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, you know, weeks and weeks on times. She always looked put together and always managed to, you know, look great on without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. I just it didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up, and so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and start this. And it's like this that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with retail. And I told her, I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They're starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands, and you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
What bank?
M&T Bank, mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I get started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan and were like, and I was like, we're off. Mm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we have a proven concept and sort of real growth. And people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. And when you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur, sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it, and everyone's going to live. And it, you know what I mean? When you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them. All of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, oh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player. And she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit. The weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going, ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and, like, be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to, like, look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and, oh, so interested in this humanities class and, wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home and because at the time it was all in our house. Like, one day a truck came and delivered all these boxes and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was. And I was like, there he is. He looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sidemen, and Sidemen being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, they sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sideman, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of, here are these things, and he's sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.